Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another outstanding episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I, of course, am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two compatriots, Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey.
And Nick Newman, an associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello. And with us today to talk about Michael Haneke's Amour, a very special guest, Peter Labuza, the host of the movie podcast, The Cinephiliacs. Hello, Peter.
Hey, guys. Thanks for inviting me on.
You're very welcome. And why don't you tell the people at home a little bit about yourself before we get into our main discussion?
Oh, about me. What could be so interesting about me? I'm a writer for IndieWire, The Playlist, and Review Online. And then I run this podcast, The Cinephiliacs, which has been described as sort of WTF with Marc Maron, except for film critics and distributors and programmers. So it's a really interesting podcast. So I hope people listening to this show, if you like this show, I'm sure you'll like my show. So please check it out. www.thecinephiliacs.net.
Excellent.
It's a great show.
Thank you.
All right. Today, as I said, we'll be talking about Amour. Before that, we'll be having a discussion of the themes of Michael Haneke movies to kind of prime us to dive into his latest, which is actually nominated for numerous Academy Awards. And then, after the review, we'll be talking about things coming out to Blu-ray in theaters that you should check out, or maybe not. And then we'll be giving you a random recommendation, something we watched on our own. So, let us begin at the beginning. Let's talk about Michael Haneke. So, Peter, since you're the guest, why don't you kick us off and talk about some of the themes that you think are prevalent in Michael Haneke's work?
Well, when I think about Michael Haneke and his various films like Cachet, The White Ribbon, The Piano Teacher, his two versions of Funny Games, the one word that always pops into my head is manipulation. This idea that he's interested in the idea that films manipulate us, you know, which I think we all recognize when we watch a film, music, the shot choices, you know, the use of violence, sex, whatever. It's all a style of manipulation. And I think what Haneke is interested in whenever he's making a film is one, like really, really manipulating us in a really, really bold way, but two, also making us aware of that manipulation. He wants us to recognize the fact that we're being manipulated by what he's showing on screen or not showing on screen. Obviously, his films are known for, you know, a lot of violence, but then a lot of not showing of violence. So this idea of watching a film and then, but knowing that you're watching a film and being both in the narrative but also removed from it, I think is something that is a reason I keep returning for his films. What about you guys?
Well, that's actually an interesting claim, and I agree with it, but it's interesting in the sense that he is after manipulation, and yet a lot of his trademark techniques would normally suggest realism, such as like the long takes and the static camera. And I think it's kind of fascinating the way he manages to juxtapose those two things. To me, another major theme of his work is kind of like the dissection of the nuclear family and putting them in really, really grueling situations and seeing how they respond. Obviously, one of the first things that points this out, as has been documented a few times, is that the couples in his films tend to be named the same, the man George and the woman Anne. So there's clearly like a kind of thematic connection between his couples. And, you know, without trying to spoil anything, if you just look at the plots of certain films of his, from The Seventh Continent to Benny's Video to both Funny Games films and, of course, Amour, Cachet too, there are a lot about kind of shoving violence into the domestic kind of environment and just seeing how those people react and how their bonds hold up under pressure if they do.
Yeah, and I also think that as a film artist, it's fascinating to look at the way he has this obsession with diegetic and non-diegetic images, which is something that I feel like is sort of overlooked a lot when his work is discussed. But it's most prevalent, for instance, in Cachet, where often you're watching the film and you're not even aware that what you're watching is a pre-recorded image that another character is actually watching on a television screen. And that extends to some of his earlier work, such as Benny's Video, which was mentioned, or 71 Fragments of a Chronology of Chance, too, which uses news reports to a great effect. And I think that, you know, being a cinema studies student myself, when you talk about Haneke or Hanukkah, however you want to pronounce it, you often meet people who are almost sort of afraid of watching one of his films, mm-hmm. which I think is ironic because for me, his work is eminently watchable in most definitions of that word, because there's an energy and a confidence that runs through them that makes them entirely gripping. And even his weakest output, which for me would probably be Time of the Wolf and The Piano Teacher, could be said to have this.
You're a madman. What is wrong with you, Nick?
I'm sorry. And yeah, his formal expressions to me are always invigorating. I'm a, you know, personally, I have a deep, unbreakable love of static shots. So you can imagine that a lot of his work really speaks to me, particularly, again, Cachet. But there's a lot of this in Amour and Funny Games, too. And, you know, Danny talks about how he's always pushing these characters to the limit. And he could be said to do, I mean, yeah, he could be said to be doing the same for audiences. But I do feel as if, through his expressions, he's actually implicating us as well in what he is doing. And that to me makes him a great artist, is how he's involving people directly, which I think is directly on display in Amour too.
Oh yeah. I mean, my friends asked me why I continue to watch this man's films because I don't think I've ever come out of one like really happy or elated. And a lot of my friends are the type of people who are not going to watch a film to be depressed. And it really is weird how he makes you a participant in the viewing of what's going on. You're not just sitting there dispossessed from it. You know, you're not taking it in passively. There's something about the way that he works and the way that his themes meld in with his style that just pulls you in and makes you an accomplice to everything that's going on. And it's almost like terrifying sometimes how he does it. And I think that even more than manipulation, the idea of surveillance or like, and now I can't think of the word, voyeurism really comes into it. You know, the long shots, the static shots, they make you almost uncomfortably intimate with these people and things that are going on. And they'll hold on something that's completely unnecessary to the plot even. And it feels like you're peering in even deeper into the lives of these people. And it just gets really uncomfortable. But there's something so engrossing about that. And like I said, the way that that technique will play into the theme of the film, it's something else, man. I really don't know how to explain it beyond that.
Yeah, he's quite adept at melding form and theme, basically. Yeah.
That's why I think Cachet, for me, is my favorite of his films because, you know, it's set up that there's so many scenes where you're, quote, watching these videotapes that these, quote, you know, already recorded images. And so as the film goes on, you become aware of the form and in a way that you start noticing when shots are static and when they're not. And you start trying to pay attention to certain details based on how the film is being shot at the time. And that's, I mean, I kind of love films that sort of teach you to watch the film as you're watching it. And, you know, it brings you even more like one of you guys said earlier about the idea of like, you know, implicating the spectator because you get more and more involved in this mystery. And then, you know, he of course pulls the rug completely under you by the end of the film.
Yeah. And that film, I mean, they have so many extended static shots that you almost become forced to try to find out details within them, which is the type of thing that you're going to need for the last shot. So yeah, what you said about the movie teaching you to watch it as you're watching it. My favorite film from him is Time of the Wolf, Nick. I don't understand why you have a problem with that film. I believe on Twitter that you called it junk.
I did, yeah. That's the one film of his I actively dislike.
That is ludicrous.
Well,
that's another one of those films. It's just, it's so good, and it drops the little hints as to its story so sparingly that by the time you get to the end, you don't even realize how much is on the line until shit starts to happen. And it's such a punch. It's such a terrible, awful, like, smack in the face from this wonderful director. I just don't know how you couldn't like it. It's kind of depressing me, man. I don't know.
Well, I'll give it a rewatch. My favorite is Cachet, which I think is easily among the best films of the last decade.
Oh, yeah. I can get behind that.
Seconded.
Yeah. It's a film that does grow. It's not that it just grows with each viewing. It's that my own perceptions of it and theories about it change with each viewing, too. Of course, you know, it has the central mystery of who sent the tapes. And the first time I saw the film, I was actually trying to figure out who did that. And then over time, I just grew to realize, well, you know, it's completely irrelevant as to what is actually happening plot-wise, and it's more about the thematics and the form. But nevertheless, I do think that it's a movie which excels above all its others because it is the most traditionally regimented, I think, in terms of how its story plays out and how Haneke is looking at this typically normal family around whom probably a more conventional narrative would normally center with any other filmmaker. But the way he cuts into their lives, and maybe I'm hinting at what I think my theory on the film's central question is, but the way he cuts into their lives is just a masterstroke. No pun intended for a more.
Oh my God. That is awful, Nick. Jesus. Okay.
I do know a lot of people who actively dislike Haneke, love a lot of, you know, cinephile films. They're not exactly, you know, they find Haneke's sort of his idea, because a lot of his films, especially, you know, you look at the two versions of Funny Games, which are essentially the same film, and that sort of Haneke's films are built around one single thing in which he just pounds the same idea into you. In Funny Games, it's this idea, you're watching a movie and you want to see, you know, violence and sex, and I'm literally going to look into the camera and tell you, you're not going to get what you want. And they find the same issues with some of his other films, even with Amour as well, that, you know, he's just sort of like this cinematic bad boy who just wants to, you know, torture his audience and, you know, has no, quote, depth besides the shallow premise that his films are built on. I kind of disagree with that, but I kind of find it interesting that there's that response out there.
I find that interesting that it would apply to Amour. I feel like this is, if anything, his least aggressively uncomfortable film, maybe? Am I wrong about that? Okay.
We'll get into that into the review.
We will get into that in the review. I don't know. It just feels to me like this is between, you know, Cachet, Funny Games, Time of the Wolf, this is the least, at least openly and perversely, you know, aggressive. Like, this doesn't have a plot that requires violence or anger. You know what I mean? I'm not putting this well, I don't think.
I very strongly disagree, so.
All right, well, I look forward to getting into that. I can totally understand how some people could see that about him. He is not an easy man to get along with.
He's actually, I interviewed him for The White Ribbon, and he's very, very nice in person.
See, that's the weird thing. Like, I see these films, and I wonder, like, who is the man behind these? And I've never seen an interview with him or anything, but, I mean, he just seems like if he makes these films, he must be, like, so cerebral, maybe. So for you to say that he's, like, a really nice guy is just weird to me. Yeah. I mean,
and if you read his Twitter account, too, he seems pretty fun.
Oh, yeah, no, and his Twitter account was a revelation for me. I mean, I know that English is probably at least his second or third language, but the guy really needs to learn to spell.
Yeah.
That Twitter account is actually his masterpiece, if I may be so bold.
No, totally. That's definitely his masterpiece right there. Oh, my God. Everybody, his Twitter account is not real. I just don't want, like, some misguided person to be like, oh, he's on Twitter.
You see, William Friedkin responded to it as if it was a real account.
Oh, my God.
What do you say?
Oh, it's something like, thank you for following me. Like, I love you and Susie, okay. Who's his wife, Susie Haneke. It was kind of just this hilarious moment.
That's so funny.
Oh, my God. I think the weird thing about that account, though, is that if it wasn't for the type of movies that he made, that account would be just, like, kind of stupid, really ridiculous. But it reaches some kind of weird amalgamation of, like, ethereal comedy to have him be like portrayed in such a way after you've seen all of his films. And it almost makes me wish that he was like that, constantly haranguing Terrence Malick.
Yeah.
Anyway, now that Nick has derailed the conversation again, any other thoughts in general on Hanukkah before we get into our review of Amore?
Has anyone seen Code Unknown?
Yeah.
I unfortunately have not, no.
Okay. Because that's a film that, like, I know a lot of critics I really respect say that they think that's his best film.
It is a masterpiece.
That's just a movie that, like, I've only seen once, and I feel like I need to see it maybe, like, four times before I can form a thought about it.
Okay. That's also a good example of his manipulation of diegetic and non-diegetic images because of the way he breaks form in one particular moment. It's actually the cover of the film's DVD, for a slight spoiler, which I think is probably the... that's the pivot point of the film for me when I realized what level he was operating on. And when I was able to fully tap in, Peter talks about how, you know, he teaches you to watch a film as you're watching it. And that is probably, I think, the best example in his entire filmography of that.
All right.
Yeah. So Code Unknown.
Code Unknown. Watch it.
Get out. Yeah.
All right. But now let us get into our feature review of Amore, written and directed by Michael Haneke.
Maman? Tout à l'heure, quand je suis entrée, je me suis rappelé comment je vous écoutais toujours faire l'amour quand j'étais petite. Ça me donnait le sentiment que vous vous aimiez et qu'on resterait toujours ensemble.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a? Qu'est-ce qu'il y a?
Amore, which stars Jean-Louis Trintignant and Emmanuel Riva, is the story of George and Anne. Can I just call him George? I feel really awkward trying to pronounce it with a French accent. Okay. George, even though I know Nick is just waiting for the next instance of me saying Renaissance.
Yeah.
All right. The story of George and Anne, who are a happy married couple, until Anne suffers a stroke which leaves her paralyzed on one side of her body, and this movie charts the slow decline in Anne's health and the ways in which George and Anne try to deal with her affliction, among many, many other things. That is the barest bones plot description that I feel I can muster. So let's talk about it. Nick, why don't you kick us off?
Okay, yeah. Amore, you know, we talked about it very, very briefly, at least I did, on the Best of 2012 episode, because I had just seen it hours before, so I didn't have enough time to fully sit on it and process it and discuss, but here we are now. And yeah, so Amore I am quite fond of. I wouldn't say that it is his... I don't think it's his best work, necessarily. Then again, if I think Cachet is his best work, I'm kind of maybe setting a bar that's a little too high, but nevertheless... yeah, this is probably the most emotionally affecting work of his career, but not for the reasons that people are always going into. I think that this is also probably the coldest and most ruthless film he's ever made. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's because what Haneke is doing here is he isn't conforming to traditional modes of representation that would normally go hand in hand with a drama of this particular sort. So for me, he's taking this objective stance and he's looking at this woman die, and he's not asking you to have any sort of emotional reaction. You're just watching it and you are reacting as it goes. You're reacting accordingly, however you feel is appropriate. And to me, that is what makes Amore such a strong work, is the fact that he's not expecting much from the audience necessarily. He's sort of placing them in the situation and then he's saying, okay, go ahead and play along, basically. And I think that it does make it a difficult film to discuss in a more traditional sense, because it's not something that, if somebody hasn't seen the film, I don't know how much of it would really click an actual discussion of it. But all the same, I mean, I think that the film is anchored by two incredible performances, particularly by... maybe I'm in the minority here, where I actually prefer the work of Jean-Louis Trintignant to Emmanuel Riva.
No, I'm on your side with that.
Okay. Don't get me wrong, Emmanuel Riva is wonderful, but I would have to go with Trinh Nhân, who I think is given a much heavier assignment. And on top of that, I also am completely in awe of his manipulation of interior spaces in this film. I can't remember the last movie I saw where I was this well acquainted with one living area as in a moor, which I guess is a little bit of a cheat because the entire film takes place in a small apartment. So, you know, you're probably used to it the way you're used to Jerry Seinfeld's apartment or something after you see enough episodes of Seinfeld, which is a weird comparison, I know, but...
Yeah, I feel like I need to pump in the Seinfeld music right now.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, though, because there was a point where I began to predict, like, the path that they would take to go places. Like, it was like I was having a dream about my childhood home. It was very weird.
And I think that, you know, you could throw criticisms at perhaps the feeling that, as Peter mentioned, he's a little one-track-minded here, and maybe some of the symbolism is a little heavy-handed. We all probably know what I'm referring to in this instance. You know what I am speaking of. But at the same time, I think there's an earnestness to this movie. It's not a kind earnestness in the sense that, you know, War Horse had kind earnestness or something. of a much
I'm
different
sorry. Story. I always laugh when I think of War Horse.
Oh, okay. but yeah, Moore is something that I'm very happy to be discussing, and I think that it's a movie I'm going to be watching for years to come, for better or for worse.
All right. And Danny, what about yourself?
I think Amor is an amazing movie. And actually, the more I've been thinking about Haneke's filmography, you know, to prepare for this show, the more I've kind of appreciated it as an anomaly, somewhat of an anomaly within his body of work. I think that for me, it's the only film he's made where performance has really transcended direction, in the sense that I usually feel when I'm watching his movies that his directorial voice is kind of overshadowing the work to an immense extent, and that the actors kind of come off as pieces within that puzzle, which isn't a knock, because that's just how he works. But I think there's something about this film and this situation and casting these two kind of giants of international cinema that just makes these performances almost like treasures of just human expression. And there are times where Emmanuel Riva could be doing something as simple as just kind of like putting her glasses on to read something or look at a photo album. And it's just like, it's one of the most powerful moments that he's maybe ever captured. And I agree with Nick that Jean-Louis Trintignant has kind of not got as much recognition as her, probably because it's, you know, the role that isn't the physically impaired character, but he definitely does have the bulkier assignment in terms of kind of like navigating all these conversations with Isabel Huppert comes in. You know, we really get a sense of how he's dealing with this. So I think just to sum up briefly, I really love Amor, and I think that it's interesting in terms of how it plays a little bit differently than some of Haneke's other great films.
And Peter, what about yourself?
Yeah, I liked it more. It's been actually a while since I've seen it. I saw it in October at the New York Film Festival, but it has stayed with me. You know, it's this sort of weird film, like you guys have mentioned, that's sort of this oddball in Haneke's career, as like this film that's, you know, more emotionally devastating. You're more affected with the characters, but at the same time, you still get that sense of like Haneke taking you through this really cruel story. You know, you have to watch all these scenes of George helping Anne, you know, go to the bathroom, move around, you know, pick her up. And those are really, really just tough scenes to watch. I think the difference with this film, which you guys have mentioned, is that Trintignant and Riva are, you know, so lived into these characters and these performances, and they don't, you know, they give them a human edge that I don't think you see even with like the actors that Haneke's worked with before, like Huppert and Juliette Binoche and Daniel O'Toole. I think there's something more emotional about watching these two, you know, titans just really, really barrow into these characters. That's the early scene in the film in which Anne has the stroke. And, you know, George sort of like, at first he can't tell what's wrong, and he's trying to feel her face. And then he slowly gets up to go get his shoes or call a hospital, and then he comes back and Anne's completely fine. It's like this really, really haunting, odd moment that is, like all of Hanukkah's works, kind of, you know, pure manipulation, but in a lot of ways, because of the performances that these two actors are giving, you sort of just, you find yourself way more emotionally involved than you usually do in a Hanukkah film. And I think the idea of, you know, this title being Love, it's sort of this horror film about a guy who basically loves his wife that he's been with, you know, for probably 40, 50 years. And it's a film about him, you know, the power of loving someone, but how that takes to a dangerous extent where he's literally like keeping her alive despite the fact that she's slowly fading away. And it becomes more horror affecting as you see him sort of close down the environment of this apartment, you know, kicking out the nurse, not returning his daughter's calls. And it becomes very, very frightening by the end.
Yeah, I think frightening is an excellent word for it. Not only in the fact of what he's doing, but just in the fact that I think one of the reasons this movie affected me so much, let me begin by saying, is the idea that of all of Haneke's films, this is the one that is most likely to happen to me. Do you know what I mean? Like, odds are that I'm never going to be secretly videotaped. Odds are that the world isn't going to end and I'm going to have to go to a train station. Odds are, however, that at some point, if I become married, one or both of us is going to start declining in our 80s, you know. God provide that we live until our 80s, but there's so little you can do about that, and just facing that reality is awful. And seeing these two people having to go through that, I mean, that's first scene where she does have the stroke and he's trying to get a reaction out of her, and then he goes to get dressed to go get help, and then he just hears the water turn off and she's acting as though nothing had happened. I mean, it's terrifying because you're there, you're alone in this house. Like, age and life have brought you together and kept you basically isolated. And suddenly the only other person that's there for you is there's something wrong that you don't know what to do. And then there's the camera work, which is, of course, great. The cinematography is beautiful, but it always lingers and it doesn't give you anywhere to go. And it's so hard to continue watching this. This will forever be the movie that ruined my Saturday night. Because I saw it, and then almost immediately I went to a club with some friends, and it was just like, no matter what kind of music was playing, no matter what I had had to drink, I was still in the film. Like, there was not a single moment where I didn't close my eyes and see some shot from the film or replay some line of dialogue. George has a very affecting monologue about losing an artifact from his childhood. And just that monologue, even if I had just read that on paper, would have affected me. And Trintignant's Young's work in delivering that monologue made it even more painful. So, is this a good movie? Can anything that hurts you as much as it did me really be said to be good? I suppose so. You can like a song that makes you cry. You can like a movie that makes you think about your own eventual mortality. So yeah, I'd have to say that I really liked it more. I don't know if it's my favorite Haneke film. I've seen all the ones that I've seen at least twice, so I want to give this one another watch. But yeah, this is going to be one of those films where I just kind of silently beat my head against a wall to try to make my thoughts on it known.
Yeah.
It's hard. Yeah. It's a difficult thing to burrow into. It's hard to get distance from it, I think, is the worst part. Like, I can't look at this the way I'd look at, say, The Hobbit or Flight, because those movies...
Whoa, Hobbit and Flight in the same?
Nothing related to quality. Okay. I was trying to actually think of two films one film that I hated and one film that I liked.
All right, very good.
I mean by saying that is that in those films, I can perfectly say I'm never going to be an alcoholic pilot, and I'm never going to be a hobbit in a company of dwarves going to fight a dragon. But whenever I think about Amor, just the fact that I went through that story with these people, it makes me consider my own future in a very uncomfortable and terrifying way. And so it's difficult to get the perspective on it that another film would afford me.
There's a scene in Amor that the one that just killed me is there's a scene in which, you know, Reva has a stroke And there's a scene in which Isabelle Huppert playing the daughter comes and visits her. And at this point, she's basically, her mind is completely gone. Or if it is there, actually, I think that's one of, I think Riva's best scene is where you can tell there's probably some cognitive information going on through her brain, but her physical body cannot, you know, speak in a way that's communicative. And Isabelle Huppert is visiting her and trying to like have this conversation and just visit her mother. And then she leaves the room and goes to where George is. And she just breaks down. And it's like this moment that reminded me, I had a very close family friend who had Parkinson's and sort of went through, like, I remember I would go and visit and you'd try and have a conversation with someone you can't have a conversation. And like, it's a scene like that, that just like, it just feels so true to what life is. And you just like, you feel like, oh God, like you said, Brian, you just feel like, oh God, this is going to happen to me. This is going to just be my future, which I think that's why a couple people I know don't like this film, is because they feel like Hanukkah is just playing on things that you know, he things that you know will emotionally devastate you, but he's not possibly saying, commenting on them as much as just presenting them. And I'm okay with him just presenting them, because I think there aren't films like this that really explore what it's like to die and watch someone, you know, slowly fade out of your life. And that's why I think it's a really interesting film for Hanukkah to make.
And I think that would also be too, I mean, not that, I don't see that as an illegitimate criticism. I can understand that, but I think it's also to ignore the formal exertion here too, which is among his finest, I would argue. You know, it's not just, again, as I mentioned, the manipulation of interior space and your understanding of it and how that affects the story, but also in particular, the way he's using mirrored imagery, too. I think of the first time that they're in the apartment and the last time that George is in the apartment as well, which I think is probably the most touching moment of the entire movie. And there's also sort of an interesting manipulation of visual geometry here. Too. One shot that sticks out to me, Danny, you'll know it well because it was actually the image you used when you chose it as your like number five film, which is the image of two doors that are open.
Yeah.
And there's a corner of a wall directly in the center of the frame. And it's things like that which just sort of, I talked about before how Haneke's decisions as a filmmaker always speak to me. And that's another example of it where I'm tuning into it directly as he's presenting this image to me, because I understand what he's communicating and I know exactly why it is so powerful. And it doesn't have to work for everybody, but I do think that it goes past the surface level of the sadness of watching an old person die. It goes past the fact that, oh, well, this is something that you can either relate to or this is something that you can anticipate for yourself. And that's what makes a more such a lasting work to me, which I think speaks to it most of all, is that I'm not necessarily thinking about the difficulty that comes with, oh, yes, watching her, you know, have to be picked up from the toilet or have to be walked into bed or the struggle she has reading a book. It goes past that for me. It goes past those more simple emotional forms of modes of entry.
Just to respond to both of your comments, I think Peter... what you said kind of really spoke to the way I reacted to the movie, because to me, there's something about Haneke's signature technique that sort of inherently does a lot of justice to this story that normally wouldn't be done in other hands. Because to me, like the actual horror version of this film would be, you know, a film with like an overbearing score and just trying to tug at your heartstrings every single moment. I think there's something about the way Haneke does it that actually feels like he understood the subject and wanted to put that on screen rather than just get a standard emotional reaction. And I think it's more kind of resonant as a result of that. As for Nick's comment, I agree that there's definitely a lot of things going on outside of that, but it also for me stops short maybe of like the sort of meta textual commentary of like Cachet or Funny Games or Benny's Video. Like a lot of his movies, a disordinate amount, are very heavily about the process of making movies or watching movies, and I definitely don't know if that's here. And so I think that's another reason why it's a little bit of an anomaly.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do think that is true, that it doesn't have as much of an obsession with the idea of an image on a screen. But I think that it certainly has the effect that Peter talked about earlier, where you're watching a film and you're being taught how to watch it as it goes along, mm-hmm. which I think is definitely true of Amour, as much as his other films.
And I believe, Danny, just in the idea of like something you said, I believe the reason Hanukkah wanted to make this film when he spoke at the New York Film Festival is he said that he had an aunt that he had to go through this process with. And that was what sort of inspired him to finally, you know, sit down and write the screenplay for this. So he was definitely working off his own memory of having to go through this traumatic experience. Not the complete same way as I'm sure if we get into spoiler territory, this film ends up. But it's certainly something similar.
Yeah, and we will be getting into spoilers. It's weird because I don't know what to qualify as a spoiler in this. This is one of those movies where I feel like you could talk about scenes and then give no context to what they're doing and it would be fine, but some people might view it as some kind of a break. So if we are done talking about primarily the themes and our reaction to the film, we could jump into spoilers now.
Well, the film opens with you knowing that Emmanuel Reva's character dies.
Yes.
But it's the way that she dies.
It's the way that she gets there.
That's true.
I mean, that's one of my friends said that. You know, I began the film, and the film opens with this really... There's something so weird about Hanukkah's work and his symmetry and the clean lines of his style. His compositions feel so unforced and so simple, and yet they're so powerful. So when the police knock in this door, it's one of the more jarring things I've ever seen on film in like the last 3 or 4 years.
And it has that great way that it sets up all the credits, and then you get that, you know, that break in,
yeah.
the long shot all the way to Reva's body in this very odd position where her body, you know, is decrepit, but it's, you know, set up in this presentation of this beautiful black dress and the flowers. And then it just cuts to the title, Amour,
yeah.
Which, you know, of course means love in French. And it's sort of, you can sort of feel the Hanukkah, like, touch of just like it feels sort of like a bad joke in a way,
but the black humor of it, yeah.
Mm.
It's sort of like Funny Games where they're listening to classical music and trying to like name the composer, and then suddenly it cuts to like terrifying grindcore punk rock as the word Funny Games comes up. I mean, yeah, it's like a friend of mine saw that opening talking about Amour again, and he said, okay, that's the worst possible way to open a film like this, because you know that her dying is not going to be the worst part of what you see.
It's a good way to put it.
That's
interesting, yes, yeah.
Absolutely. I was like, this is Michael Hanukkah. He's putting it forward. He's like, look, this is how it ends. It's only going to get worse from here.
I do think, actually, I would disagree. I think that's the one favor he pays the audience at the beginning, is providing by far the worst image in the entire film. And also sucking the tension out of it, because knowing that she's going to die is a brilliant move, because now there would have been a sense of tension present that I think would have hurt the drama that follows. But but going back to that shot, I mean, it's something that I mean I saw the film 2 weeks ago, and I still haven't been able to get that image out of my head as much as I would like to, because it is just among the most upsetting things I think he's ever photographed in a film, and by a very fair margin too. So I mean, it's just a very visceral feeling that I got when I saw that shot of her lying dead on the bed surrounded by flowers.
Yeah, and that does set up a very, it's an interesting way to introduce us to the relationship as well, you know, between the two main characters. I mean, because that's the first image you get of either of them, and what you get is, you know, locked room, and then tape around the doors, and then her dead in a dress with the flowers around her hair. And it's just like, that's your introduction to their relationship, and it's at the point where the relationship is over. It's weird. It's... weird isn't the right word. It's haunting. It's disconcerting. It's so many different things. Because just from that tableau, you can kind of get an idea of the type of relationship that they had and the type of person that he was to love her that much and go through all that. And then just wondering why people had to knock a door in to come and find her. It sets up the movie in a very interesting and uncomfortable
there's a
way.
It creates a tension. It's like, you know, the tension isn't going to be about, oh, is this person going to die or not? It's like, what could happen in this, quote, very, very loving relationship that this that would create this such an odd, bizarre image? And the way that the film gets there, I find fascinating and odd. And if we want to get into spoilers, I think where the film sort of gets its limit, some of its limitations for me.
Okay, yeah, so let's do it. Let's get into spoilers.
Pigeons,
guys. Nick had heavily tipped to the idea that there were pigeons in this film. I saw the first pigeon scene, and I thought that I knew what he was talking about. And then the second pigeon scene happened. So, Nick, why don't you talk to us about pigeons?
in the film, George encounters, I believe, the same pigeon. I don't understand how it could... In the logic of the film, I understand how it could be two different pigeons, because then it would kind of... A lot of the thematics would kind of buckle under themselves if it wasn't. So let's just assume it's the same. And, you know, in the first part, he, you know, it flees his apartment after he's scaring it away. Am I remembering this correctly?
Yes, you are.
Yep. And then the second time, he puts a blanket over it, and you see him grab it, and he's kind of sitting in a chair, and it looks as if he's almost going to start using it for comfort. But then the film cuts away to him writing a letter, and... It's a very strange element, because the film is so closed off and so sequestered into this home that when you throw in this element, it cannot mean something relevant.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I think is a problem, because...
Wait, the pigeon's a metaphor? Sorry.
That's fine. What was interesting is that I looked up... I actually Googled Amour pigeon just to kind of figure out what other people were saying about it. I wasn't sure if maybe everyone else thought the same thing as myself. And then I found an interview with Haneke where he said that the pigeon doesn't actually mean anything specific, and that it is something that he says he doesn't know what it means, and that it could mean whatever you want. He's sort of allowed you to bring something extra to the table to figure it out. I don't know what you guys think of that idea.
So in his eyes, the pigeon's like a little treat for us.
Yeah.
A little something extra that we can
do
something with.
Choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of read it as like, you know, this film is a lot about, you know, intrusion and this idea that, you know, George wants to cut off everyone from this space. You know, it begins with that shot, like we talked to the police breaking down the door. And there's a discussion early in the film about, I believe, like the alarm system and possible burglars. And, you know, this pigeon is like the one intruder into the house that gets in, you know, and the scene sort of like has this weird comicality. And this is where I think I have some issues with the film, is I think that and the couple of dream sequences and possibly the way that Emmanuel Riva's character finally dies in the film, it kind of feels incongruous with a lot of the other stuff in the film. It feels very Hanukkah in that way, that Hanukkah wants to have like these moments of, you know, pure manipulation or thrills or black humor. But I don't know if that is appropriate for what does work in the film for me. It feels like Hanukkah trying to make a different movie out of this movie when he should have been more focused and more gone away from some of his bad boy techniques like we talked about in the first part of the show. I feel that's the part of the film where I get a little lost.
It feels like one of the only leaks in a very tight ship.
I didn't find it to be a leak. I didn't know what the hell was going on, but for some reason it felt appropriate, perhaps. I don't know. I was actually really impressed with George's pigeon catching abilities. I'm not saying this. I mean, I know it's funny to say, but I'm being completely sincere. Like, as he was walking through and closing all the doors, I was just like, right, so the pigeon can't get into another room. That's incredible, because I have had birds stuck in my house and none of us have been smart enough to do that. I don't know why. I have absolutely no idea why. I don't know what it means. I tried to think about it. I came to the idea of intrusion, much as you did. And I guess it works best, and it's kind of weird because, you know, his daughter comes over to help, ostensibly, to do something, and he kind of tries to keep her out. And so then you have this pigeon that could symbolize that same idea of something entering, and then whether to embrace it and use it for comfort or to just toss it out again. And we all know that George ends up tossing it out. He's writing a letter of some kind, which is how we know that he releases the pigeon. Is the implication there that he's writing the letter to his wife?
I thought it was to his daughter.
Yeah, that's kind of what I had thought too. Either that or to maybe whatever authorities were going to enter the house, which is what crossed my mind at that moment, because you knew that they'd be entering eventually. But no, it never occurred to me that it would be his wife.
Okay, I thought that because he had begun to tell her stories from his childhood that he had never told her before. Mm. And so I thought that this was him trying to offer up some kind of continuation to that, you know, sort of like journaling, but believing.
No, that's certainly interesting. It's been too long since I've seen it, so I can't.
Because from my point of view, it wouldn't make sense that he's writing it to his daughter, because he doesn't seem to share much with his daughter.
That's true. There seems to be like some sort of a distance between them that is, you know, goes unexplained in the film, between Isabel Huppert's character and George and Anne, that she's sort of, you know, she's living in England with Kim Chanel from Certified Copy, the Keir Starmer film I love so much, isn't given that much to do, but it's just nice to kind of see him on screen. But I think there's an unspoken distance between, and there's sort of like this uncomfortableness that George has with Huppert visiting, even though it's her mother is dying, but there seems to be some sort of tension between them in all the scenes they have.
I think that it's probably just a case of my daughter's making terrible life choices. Because everything that we hear about Joff, I'm just going to call him Jeff. I keep trying to go for the pronunciation. It's
George
really
and Jeff.
George and Jeff. Everything that we hear about Jeff does not sound particularly wonderful. Apparently, he's a constant philanderer, and he almost drove a violinist to suicide, which is, you know, not something that a good person does. But yeah, and
I've read a couple of interesting interpretations where it's actually the daughter's character, where some people think that the kind of Haneke horror aspects come into play, in the sense that he's filming a couple that is almost perversely more dedicated to themselves and their offspring. And I think that that's something I'll be looking to explore more as I revisit the film, because the first time I saw it, I definitely didn't have that reaction, but the more I think about it, the more there's probably some unique implications that are being made.
Well, it's like the love of the title is both like this thing that's like a gesture of like, you know, that's beautiful, but it's also this gesture of horror. There's a scene in which Anne is like, Anne refuses to eat like the sort of applesauce or whatever thing that George is trying to feed her. She keeps like throwing away, and then George gets so angry that he slaps her. And I think that's like the super frightening moment in the film, that, you know, he's so in love with her and wants to keep her so, like, you know, alive in the way that he's always wanted, like, been with her, that he gets so angry that he gets violent with her in order to preserve this thing that he had with her. And it's sort of like this is really crazy moment.
Yeah, that was a jarring scene.
For those of us who saw it in the theater, was there the expected audience at that moment?
at the moment when she finally lets her leave her body?
No.
When he hits her.
Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was... I saw this in a full theater, which was an interesting experience, particularly since I saw this at Film Forum, which Peter and Danny will know, has a lot of elderly visitors.
Yeah, and it's cash only.
Yeah.
It's always that, people in their 60s and 70s.
Yeah, during the smothering scene, a woman sitting in the row in front of me to the left just put her head down for the entire moment, which I shouldn't laugh because, you know, I suppose it's an understandable reaction, but it was good to see this with an audience, I think. I think it was a shared experience, which... speaks to the film's power.
Not to go back to Cachet, but I mean, still one of my favorite moments ever in my movie going is the guest in that certain scene in Caché, in which you could hear a pin drop, like, easily. Like, it was just all the air was sucked out of the room in that certain moment in Caché. I'm trying to be very ambiguous here. I think that's one of Haneke's best things, is creating moments that literally just suck the air out of the room in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, the film ends not with the smothering, which is kind of an eventuality that I think... First of all, were any of us expecting that he would actually do it? Were we thinking that he would just let her slip away, or did we think that he would proactively go for it?
I had read before I saw the film that someone said that he euthanized her.
What?
Which is sort of technically correct, but I thought it could be a very gentle moment where he had a almost like a
Dr.
medical
Kevorkian type
mask, where he'd put it over her face and she'd just sort of pass away. Not that. And I think that, so what was your original question?
Well, apparently you read a spoiler beforehand. I was wondering if in the course of the film, people got the idea that he was going to kill her in some way, or did we think he was just going to let her slip away on her own?
I did, and I thought originally he was going to try and preserve her as much as possible all the way, you know, to that, quote, the first scene in which we see her body just, you know, as beautifully preserved. So it does work as, you know, a shock. And I think that's, again, a question of I have is whether it's congruous with the rest of the film, or is it Haneke just putting in a shock because he wants to have that sort of shock? Or, I mean, what did you guys think? I'm sort of still wrestling with it in a lot of ways of whether it fits with these characters in this film.
No, I think that it fits, because I think that it's his final expression of love toward her, because earlier there's...
Absolutely.
A scene where she says something to the effect of, well, why don't you just kill me? Because I'm just a burden to you, and I'm not really the same person when I'm in this state. And that was his final gesture, really, past the flowers and the dress and whatnot. But that was the last thing that he could really do for Anne, which I found very moving, even though it is a very disturbing and upsetting idea. It did affect me, and the way I believe it's fully intended. I think that it's absolutely an act of love.
I have to agree. I mean, when he did it, when it happened, as much as it was awful to witness, part of me was very glad that he was doing it, because it was a selfless... Because the obvious thing is, you know, usually you think about someone euthanizing a sick relative or something, and you have this idea like they just don't want the burden. You know, it's a terrible, awful way to look at it, but there's that presumption. And this is a man who absolutely doesn't mind having this burden. He doesn't even view it as a burden. It's still his wife. And so for him to come in and soothe her with the story that I talked about earlier about losing the postcard that he'd sent his mother that was covered in stars, and then to, you know, very rapidly grab a pillow, put it over her face, and snuff the life out of her. It's really difficult to talk about this movie because I just want to slip into like a depressive state where I don't say anything. I kind of want to crawl back into bed. It was great that he did that. I mean, it's like I said, it's harrowing and it's awful, but I saw him doing it and I was just kind of like, okay, good. Because that was what she wanted, and it's better that way, I guess. I mean, like, Jesus, guys.
That's why I thought he was going to kill the pigeon at the end. Is like, you know, he's already snuffed one person. What's a little pigeon going to be?
I had the exact same reaction. I'm like, is this his descent? Is this he his descent becomes, into becoming a serial killer of some kind?
And then he becomes the character from Jacques Duret's The Outside Man, which Jean-Louis Trintignant plays a hitman, which is a really
is
great film from the 70s. It's a prequel to that. He goes, because he starts aging backwards, of course, which means it's also Benjamin Button, I guess.
No, I was going to say, for every life he takes, he gains the life force. Anyway, we're getting way off topic.
That's a horror film I want to see.
Isn't it? anyway.
What I really want to discuss the final moment that he's on screen, because I left the theater a little... I mean, maybe this is just very obvious and I'm just very stupid, but I did leave the theater a little confused as to what exactly
happening. The last two scenes, you mean, when he wakes up and she's cleaning and they go outside?
Right. Now, to me, that felt like... I mentioned earlier how he's using mirrored imagery, and that's a very clear mirror to the first time they enter their apartment. because the camera is just in a reverse position from where it was originally. But at the same time, I'm trying to figure out what exactly is the significance of... to me, that felt like a reflection of when she has her stroke and she's not really aware of his own actions.
Right.
And in this instance, it's, you know, he's flipping the tables here. But I'm not exactly sure what is being tapped into.
I wish I had an answer for you. That's the only thing that I can provide.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like this surreal moment that mirrors, like, remember, there's the dream earlier where, you know, he goes out into the hallway and there's the leaking water. And then, like, you know, he gets the hand over the face. It's sort of like you said, it's sort of a reverse image where now he has this final dream, whatever, or he's, you know, delusional or whatever, where he can, he's remembering his wife the way that he wants to remember his wife. And, you know, he's closed off the room. He's literally taped the door shut. So the image that he doesn't want to remember is sort of like hidden away for him to, you know, unlock from his memory. And he instead lives with the memories before, because we also see the dream earlier where he sees her playing the piano, and it's a perfect, you know, that she has a stroke in which her right hand, when she's first, you know, cognizant, her stroke is that her right hand is can't move anymore. And she's a piano player, which is this sort of like really like awful, another black joke by Haneke. You know, there's the moment earlier where he sees her playing the piano, and then you realize that he was just listening to it on tape, but he was still imagining her. So I think the end is sort of like this, him remembering his wife the way he wants to as he leaves this place behind of where this terrible incident has happened.
And the weirdest part is that it ends then not with that scene, but with the scene of his daughter walking in through the house with all the doors open. So obviously I'm presuming that this is after they've removed the body and they've cleaned up everything and the house now belongs to her. And all the doors are open. And earlier in the film, she had said that when she was young, she used to hear her parents making love and it reassured her.
Yep.
And now there's nothing but silence and they're not there. And so I feel like earlier you had said that some of the horror aspects might come from her point of view. And if that were to be true, it would definitely be driven home in that scene. Because the
passing of a torch.
Yeah. The people that she loved are gone now. She doesn't have that reassurance. She and has now a big empty house.
But now she's also in their position, basically. She has this to look forward to.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. At the end of her life with William Schimmel. Which doesn't sound that bad if it's with him. But
yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah. It was strange to see him appear and...
Yeah, I was weirded out by that. I was like, who, what, why?
Yeah, and speak French as well, which I thought.
I remember during when they were casting this film, he was cast, I was like, oh, I'm very excited. And I mean, he's not bad in the film. He just has like, what, one scene or something?
Yeah.
In which he's just kind of playing this, you know, this angry British husband. He's not sort of, his character is not really given much to do, as I think I said earlier. But I like Brian, you said earlier about, you know, the idea of the doors and the space and that final shot of like all this open space. And it sort of reminds me of, you know, like we talked about earlier, Hanukkah's sort of whether fair or not, his attack on, you know, the French bourgeois sort of life that he's done in Cachet and the piano teacher and blah, blah, blah. And like this sort of, I do like that idea of like this space finally being open, this family that's been trying to close himself off from the world, and finally everything revealed, everything is open.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right, guys.
It's actually, just quickly, now that I think about it, it really is kind of an interesting bookend to The Seventh Continent, the first feature he made, which is basically entirely about a film that willingly shuts himself off, about a family, sorry, that willingly shuts himself off from the world, kind of. Now that I think about it, the final frames of each film are kind of really eerily similar.
I have not seen that film, so I can't.
It's on YouTube, actually. Yeah.
It is?
Decent quality.
Right. A lot of stuff is on YouTube these days.
Yeah.
Is it legal?
I don't know.
But you can watch all of Howard Hawks's early silence on YouTube.
Oh, well, those have entered into the public domain, haven't they?
Yeah.
Okay, so. This is a completely different conversation. So any final thoughts to put out before we close down this discussion? We've been talking for apparently well over an hour. Nope.
Good movie.
Putting a button on it. Nick, was this a good date movie?
sort of.
It's just that there's two kinds of movies that, or two kinds of ways that a movie like this could end, I feel, if you were on a date. And one of them is you have a great discussion afterwards and you realize that the girl you're with is fantastic. And the other one is you sit there silently, like, letting your coffee cool, realizing that you can never look each other in the eyes again.
A mix of both, I would say.
All right.
I know my friend Glenn Kenny, who writes for MSN Movies, we saw it at the New York Film Fest press screening, and afterwards he went outside and called his wife and was just like, I'm sorry that this is going to happen to us in about, you know, 30 years or so.
This is after I saw Tree of Life, I immediately went out and bought a baseball glove to, like, play catch with both my nephew and my father. It's the type of movie that can do that to you, and this one is one of them. But let us move on. We're going to quickly run through everything that's coming out in Blu-ray and theaters, giving you our best selections for the week ahead, and then we'll give you a really quick synopsis of a movie that we watched on our own that we think you should check out, and then we'll be gone. So, looking at Blu-rays getting released on the 22nd of January, we have End of Watch, The Quiet Man, Ivan's Childhood, Pina, Death
Ivan
Race.
Ivanhoe's Childhood.
I know. I don't know why I went there. Ivan's Childhood. We have Pina, Death Race 3, Universal Soldier, Day of Reckoning, The Paperboy, Gamera the Brave, and For a Good Time Call, amongst a couple of other films that actually look pretty good. Searching for Sugar Man, which is getting a lot of end-of-year love. Cujo, which everyone knows is the movie about the murderous dog. And that's
Harry Curry, Death of a Samurai.
Yes. So, gentlemen, what do we think is a good bet?
Ivan's Childhood.
Well, yeah, Ivan's Childhood is Tarkovsky's first feature. And I think it's if you've seen other Tarkovsky, this one's a little different. It's this story of a boy who's basically lost his family in World War II. And it's much more of a sort of, this is a weird thing to say, a thrilling Tarkovsky film than anything else. And The Quiet Man is an Irish drama from John Ford starring John Wayne, which I've been trying to see for years and years and years. It's apparently one of his, like, best films, but it's been very hard to get, and I'm very excited for that release as well.
Yeah, The Quiet Man is a fantastic film. I'm going to buy that. I'm also going to be getting End of Watch. Did anyone else see End of Watch?
No.
Yeah, I saw that. I liked it.
Yeah, it's a very good film. I think it has one of the best male, like, friendship arcs of any film that I've seen in the last couple of years. It's a very real feeling.
I'll also put I'll throw a pitch to Universal Soldier: Day of Reckoning, which is from this director John Himes, who's this sort of like this guy. If you watch the film, you're expecting sort of this cheesy B movie. That originally was planned straight to DVD, and then you start seeing touches of David Lynch, Gaspar Noé, Francis Ford Coppola. There's a big reference to Apocalypse Now. It's not the best movie, but it's really out there for what is a Universal Soldier movie. And John Himes is sort of a director who has been working in the direct-to-DVD market, but making really, really weird, strange. He's sort of part of this vulgar tourist movement with, like, Tony Scott and Paul W.S. Anderson. So I think it's a film worth checking out because it's not what you expect.
Yeah, I am insanely curious to see this film after some of the praise I've heard. So
I have been hearing the weirdest, like, groundswell of grassroots praise, and I'm really wondering. So I might have to check it out.
Yeah, I haven't seen the previous Himes Universal Soldier film, which I believe was Regeneration. Have you, Peter?
No, but I'm really curious to check that one out, as well as Dragon Eyes, which is like a martial arts thriller. Apparently, the movie critic and former Roger Ebert show host, Ignaty Vishnevetsky, is a huge fan of John Himes and really thinks his work is fantastic. And I think Universal Soldier: Day of Reckoning is sort of like an interest, like, not a completely perfect film by any means. You don't know whether it actually all coalesces together, but it's just so visually, like, different from what you expect that it's such a fascinating, weird film.
Yeah, I heard someone call it Lost Highway for Meatheads, which definitely has me. I mean, normally I would never care about this kind of film, but critics I respect, like Vishnevetsky, have been really touting its strengths and singing its praises. So I am going to see it, and I'm going to keep an open mind, because I feel like it just seems like such a such an out there expression that I'm probably going to go with it. So I'm optimistic.
All right. Now on to the theatrical releases, which is a much drier well to dry from, draw from. Hansel and Gretel, Witch Hunters. Jeremy Renner and Gemma Arterton? Peter Stormer. Yeah, all right. Moving on.
Zoe Mark. Bell.
Who?
Zoe Bell's in it. It's good.
Yeah. Woo! Parker, starring Jason Statham.
I was actually, I'm a kind of big Statham fan, and I was excited to see this until I learned that Taylor Hackford from, like, Ray was directing
it.
Yeah,
right? Isn't that weird?
Oh, that's weird.
It's so weird. Like, every once in a while, something like this happens. I think, was that, like, Chasing Giants or something? There was some, movie.
LA Confidential.
Yeah. I was like, what is happening with these people? I don't understand.
Yeah.
Taylor Hackford also did The Devil's Advocate, so make of that what you will. moving on. We also have Movie 43, which I don't know anything about.
It stars pretty much everybody
planet. The whole marketing for the film is that everyone's in it, and it asks you what it is.
Yeah, I am baffled by this movie, and I want it to fail.
I have no idea what this is.
Yeah, it looks annoying.
Okay. So that's our endorsement, I guess.
The only recommendation I can give for this week is don't see Parker. Stay home and watch John Borman's Point Blank, which is an incredible, incredible film starring Lee Marvin from 1967, because it's based on the same novel. It's also Payback, starring Mel Gibson, was based on the same novel, too. Huh. At least I think Parker is the same story. Yeah, really? It seems to be. Yeah, because he's a criminal who gets betrayed, and he's left for dead, and he has to find the people who did it, and he teams up with a woman.
I feel as though that's a pretty basic plot.
But it's based on the writings of Donald Westlake.
Okay.
Go watch Point Blank. It's like Alphaville for America.
it's something else.
All right. Finally, John dies at the end. Race 2. Which I don't know anything about. Happy People, the newest film by Werner Herzog, and Knife Fight, which I've never heard of until this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Stars Rob Lowe and Richard Schiff.
I'll definitely see Happy People, but I haven't heard much about it. It seems like even for Herzog, it's getting a pretty quiet release.
I've heard a couple of rumblings on Twitter about how good it is, but I haven't heard any other stuff. So who knows? Who knows, guys? Again, sorry guys, not a lot coming out. Hopefully February will offer us some better stuff. Anyway, moving on. Time for our personal recommendations. Let's try to keep it as brief as possible. Nick, why don't we start with you?
So this past week, Japanese master Nikisa Oshima passed away at the age of 80, best known for In the Realm of the Senses, but also Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, starring David Bowie. And I decided February 15th, he passed away. So I decided to, in his honor, watch a film of his I had not seen. And on Hulu Plus, I watched a film called Violence at Noon. Anybody else here seen the film?
I have not, no.
Not that one.
No.
Okay. I decided to check this out after someone on Twitter called it one of the most formally inventive films they'd ever seen. And I would have to agree with it. I think that this is as much of a radicalization of form as something like The Rules of the Game or Citizen Kane or Breathless. And the fact that it's gone sort of unheralded this entire time is an absolute travesty, because this film is just a towering achievement. It's about a woman who is told by a friend of hers that her husband is a serial rapist / murderer. But she kind of is naturally, she's refusing that accusation and trying to figure out exactly where it would come from. And then she realizes that this is in fact the case. And it's about her having to deal with it while also having this moral quandary of trying to turn him into the police or figuring out something else to do. And the movie takes a multi-tiered structure to its storytelling, where it's set over a few different timelines, and it uses flashbacks, and in a few cases it uses flash forwards. And it's all in service of this tale. And it also uses these great formal tricks. There's these very sharp angles, there's these jagged cuts, there's these cameras that sort of trace the thoughts of the main characters, and it all works perfectly. I mean, it is a film that I was just completely in awe of as I was watching it. My mouth was, you know, my jaw was practically hitting the floor the entire time. And if you have Hulu Plus, or even if you don't, you can get it from Netflix. I beg you to see this film because it's like nothing I've ever encountered before. I'm still kind of reeling from it, to be honest. This is probably one of the best movies I'll watch all year.
Damn.
And it's only January.
Damn.
All right. try to follow that up, Danny.
Jesus. Molly. this week I caught up with a few kind of essential Lars von Trier films that I hadn't seen. Dancer in the Dark, Dogville, and Breaking the Waves. And
Ooh, Dogville.
Yeah.
That is a fun week.
It was not a fun week, actually. And you know, the the Haneke catch-ups I did made it even worse, you know.
Let's all give Danny a nice warm hug and thank him for still being alive.
Yeah. Benny's Video and Time of the Wolf, they don't go down well after some von Trier. But you know, all these three films are incredible, and Dancer in the Dark and Dogville are particularly kind of formally experimental and daring, but I feel like Breaking the Waves was the one I responded to most at first. Maybe just because it feels like one of the more optimistic von Trier films I've seen. Without saying what it is, the final shot in particular has to be like one of the most uplifting moments in any film of his that I've encountered. And also the lead performance of Emily Watson. I'm still trying to comprehend the fact that this was her screen debut. It's not like a kind of amateur performance like Bjork gives in Dancer in the Dark, in the sense that it sort of makes sense that Bjork is an inexperienced actor for that film. Emily Watson rather shows incredible craft and range and technique in Breaking the Waves, as if she's been in movies for like 3 decades. And I have no idea how she did that. And it's pretty amazing. So all three of those are worth seeing. But that was maybe my favorite on the first go around.
All right. And Peter, what about yourself?
I also watched Oshima called The Ceremony, which is really, really good. And I really recommend it. But the film I want to praise is I saw Brian De Palma's third movie, which is called Hi, Mom. From 1970, Ooh. Which stars a pre-Mean Streets Robert De Niro, which is one of the most subversively fantastic films. It's definitely going to be one of my favorite discoveries of the year when it comes down to December. It's sort of, you know, De Palma is one of those people who's like for fans only. You kind of have to be on his rhythms, his sort of oddball sensibilities to really like love De Palma. And I'm one of those people. And this film is basically Robert De Niro plays a peeping Tom who gets paid by a pornographic company to record people in the building across from his apartment. But he also wants to be in the video as well. So he's setting up this date with this girl. And then there's also this subplot with a black revolutionary group that's creating a play, an interactive play called Black Baby, where they take upper class white people into them and then quote treat them like black people by having them violently assaulted by cops and raped. And it's sort of this really, really, you know, screwed up movie in a lot of ways, but it's also this idea. It's sort of, I described it as Roger Corman meets Marshall McLuhan. It's all about these media images, people obsessed with recording things, watching things, and how media images, you know, are these things that are basically, it doesn't care what the material is, it's how you create the sensation of how you're watching it. And it has like the best punchline ever. It's a really, really screwed up movie. But if you love De Palma, I think this might be my favorite. And it especially shows like it was only his third movie, but this guy knew exactly what he wanted to do, you know, very, very early in his career. He always sort of had it right there from the beginning. So I really, really recommend it.
Yeah, the Be Black Baby sequence is probably, at one point, it becomes the most suspenseful of anything I've seen from De Palma, actually. And it has the biggest sense of relief by far.
It has a hilarious punchline that had me like rolling in my seats.
Right. And you completely, part of the genius of that scene is that it goes on for so long that you actually forget that it's a fictional account inside the film. And it begins to feel like a natural part of the narrative. And so when you finally realize at the end, oh no, this is fake, it is just a huge sigh of relief. And that is, Hi Mom is great. And also, I believe you saw Greetings too, right?
Yeah. Reeves is really good as well. It's a little less focused. It's sort of like this parody. I don't know exactly how to describe it. It's like three guys who are just kind of going around being like weird. One's like a JFK conspiracy theorist. One is trying to get out of the Vietnam draft. It's sort of this, you know, fuck you to the... Oh, wait, can I swear?
Oh, yeah, no. Please go ahead.
Okay. It's sort of like this fuck you to Lyndon Johnson, but through the trashiest way possible. If anyone's seen like the Czech film Daisies by, I believe, the filmmakers Vera Chekloktov.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
I'm bastardizing that name. But it's sort of like the American version of that with dudes, where it's sort of this, you know, reduces this high art political protest to the lowest, like, TNA possible.
Yeah. We should mention that they're actually... of the same, it's the same character, Robert De Niro in
right.
Wolf, which is creates an interesting thematic connection. And I just want to go on a little bit longer because I could talk about De Palma all day. I particularly like how that has an early auteurist stamp from him because of the connection not only with the JFK assassination but also to Antonioni's blow up as mm-hmm. well, which was a great discovery for me when I watched that last year. Because of course, you know, Blowout, I don't even to say it because it's so obvious, but still. When that came into the picture, I was immensely pleased to see. It's like what you said, De Palma knew what he was doing, even as this young filmmaker.
I particularly like, I said we should keep it brief, and this is still going, but this is an interesting conversation, so I'll allow it. I'm not a fan of De Palma so much, but everything that you all are saying is making me want to revisit him.
Yeah, these two are a little more difficult to find, but hopefully they'll get some reappraisal.
Well, apparently, Hi Mom is on instant video for Amazon for free, so
perfect.
If anyone wants to see it, I know I'll be watching it.
And I'm a big fan of Passion, his new film that's going to be coming out this year, which I think is like totally, it's very similar in a lot of ways to Hi Mom, as this awesome. Sort of trashy B story, but really investigating what the digital image means in, you know, our contemporary society.
I can't wait.
All right, my movie that I watched, I only had time to watch one movie outside of Amore, and I chose wisely. I chose Moonrise Kingdom. Ooh. I really don't feel like I have to tell people why I chose Moonrise Kingdom or why they should check it out, because...
because you just watched Amore, and... Actually, I suppose Moonrise Kingdom isn't much more optimistic than Amore, come to think of it.
It's a little more optimistic.
A little.
A little. Anyway, I actually find Moonrise Kingdom to be pretty optimistic, but again, not... Not going to get into it. So Moonrise Kingdom. If you want to know why I like it, just listen to our top 10, because it shows up, I think, in at least two of our top 10s, and we speak about it at great length. So that's it for today, guys. Thank you again for joining us. Let's tell the people at home where we can be found online. So, Peter, start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at Labuza Movies. That's LABUZA Movies. And I blog sort of all my work and then put up sort of random posts when I feel like it at LabuzaMovies.com. So that's where you can find me.
All right. And Nick?
You can find me on TheFilmStage.com and Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny?
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com is my personal site, and then Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And you can find me at Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. You can also find me on The Film Stage. And you can find me at my personal blog, DearFilm.net. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again for joining us. And tune in next week to see what we review then. I always feel weird putting trailer clip in for a foreign film. So, Amore, which is, again, directed by Michael Haneke, starring...
Did we just lose Peter?
Did we? Oh, son of a bitch. Peter, no!